Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. Well, what's the role you and I have in this play? Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist Trent Horn. On Mondays and Wednesdays, we talk apologetics and theology, but on Friday, we talk about whatever I want to talk about. And today I want to talk about the different stages of development that we go through in life. So right now, I feel like I'm at the midway point. I'm having a tiny, tiny midlife crisis. I'm just really nostalgic for things that I did when I was in high school or early college. So I bought a Super Nintendo Classic. I have my original Super Nintendo, but I've tucked it away safely to try to extend its lifespan. I bought a classic one more for the kids to play and for me to play with them. And an old Xbox One on eBay. So I just remember those things I used to do when I was younger. But overall, I feel very happy where I'm at. I feel very blessed that God has used my work to help so many people. He's given me all these opportunities. And I'm just so grateful that it's helped so many people to come to know our faith. So I feel gratitude, almost like a sense, I don't know the word to describe it, not fear, but this sense of, wow, God has called me to do something to help many people, like this immense sense of responsibility to soberly look at where my life has been. And I'm happy where it has gone, not just to help people, but of course to discern the vocation of marriage, to be blessed with wonderful children. And so I feel like I'm standing at a nice apex point looking forward to say, all right, this is the second half of life going forward for me. I mean, it might be as long as the first half. I mean, it might only last the rest of the day. I could get hit by a bus. You never know what might happen. But at this stage of my life is sort of the midway point. So what I want to talk about today are the different stages that we go through from beginning to end and how people grow in them and what people kind of expect in them. So I'm going to talk about the work of psychologist Erik Erikson. I also want to talk about these books about child development. It's just the titles of the books I really enjoy by Louise Bates Ames. I think they were published back in the 1970s, but their titles really summarize well the stages of development for each year of life as a child going to the age of 9. So I want to begin by reading to you a monologue from Shakespeare's As You Like It. It's often called The Seven Ages of Man or All the World's a Stage, because that's the first line. It's spoken by Jacques in Act 2, Scene 7 of As You Like It. You've heard the beginning before. It's what I read to you earlier. All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. But the monologue is a wonderful description of a person's life, particularly a man's life, going through the seven ages from infancy until old age and death. So here's how it goes. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly with good cap-and-lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved a world too wide, from his shrunk shank and his big manly voice, turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. So I love it. It's a wonderful description of what your life is like. You go, you're a baby, you're the whiny schoolboy, and then you're the teenager, young adult who just wants to find a wife, and you're emotional and romantic. But then you get down to hard tacks, you're the soldier. And especially these seven stages of the life of a man. I mean, it'd be interesting to see a parallel for women because nothing here talks about fatherhood, especially being a big part of life. More, it's about career, what talking about here for a man. So he goes from being a lover to being the soldier, you know, the young man in his 20s or 30s, hot tempered, ready to fight. He wants a reputation, even from the cannon's mouth, a bubble reputation, very easy to pop that he chases after. Then he gets wiser. He becomes the justice. He's got the round belly, puts on some weight, but he's wiser than he was when he was younger. And then he goes into the pantaloon. You know, I love the description of the pantaloon, the older guy. He's got the spectacles, the glasses, wearing the funny underwear, stockings. And even his voice goes from being deeper as it was in middle age to kind of getting softer, having more of a treble to it. And then finally, old age, when you re-enter the dependency you had as a younger child. So that's Shakespeare. Let's go through the stages of development then from Erikson. Now, I'm not endorsing everything here. A lot of modern psychology, egoist psychology, has things that are false or incorrect, but you can find nuggets that are true and interesting to reflect on. And so I find these to be generally true. So I'm going to go through the Erikson stages. And in the beginning, for children, I'm going to tie in the titles from the Louise Bates Ames series, your one-year-old, your two-year-old, your three-year-old, etc. So let's hop into it. According to Erikson, there are 8 stages in life, so pretty close to Shakespeare. And actually, the stages seem to follow that. So according to Erikson, there are 8 stages of life, so it kind of follows Shakespeare a little bit. Stage 1 is infancy. And in all of Erikson's stages, there is a fundamental battle between 2 things in a person's life, what they're going to move towards, what their ultimate emotional core is going to be, their psychological ego, things like that. So in stage 1, it's infancy, and the battle is trust versus mistrust. It says here, in the first stage of human development, infants learn to trust based on how well their caregivers meet their basic needs and respond when they cry. If an infant cries out to be fed, the parent can either meet his need by feeding and comforting the infant or not meet his need by ignoring the infant. When their needs are met, infants learn that relying on others is safe. When their needs go unmet, infants grow up to be less trusting. Oh, how sad. Imagine little infants, you are formed in that stage of life to view the world. You could be formed to either trust those who are around you or to fundamentally mistrust others and develop unhealthy relationships. So that'd be in infancy. Let's say you're 1 and you're 2-year-old. The Ames series, like I said, these are published back, I think, in like the 1970s or 80s, and the books are typical child development books. But I love the titles because the titles really do a good job of summarizing how kids are from ages 1 to 9. So it says, your 1-year-old, and the subtitles are in each one, your 1-year-old, fun-loving and fussy. Well, that's a 1-year-old. They're fun-loving. They'll giggle and laugh at everything. But man, oh man, will they get fussy about anything. As soon as that binky is gone, the pacifier, I don't know what you call it. Some people call it a chewy. Some people call it I call it a binky. A passy. Some people call it a passy. They'll spit that bad boy out. And do they trust that you will put it back in? And you want to get the little clip so they don't lose that thing. And as a parent, it's your greatest joy when finally they reach the milestone of grabbing that pacifier and putting it back into their own mouth. And it's just, you just want to throw a party. And then you got to go through the next step, which is telling them to say goodbye to their passy, goodbye to their binky. I remember for our kids, one of them, we did a little party and we said, we're going to have a party for you. You're going to take your passy, your binky, throw it in the garbage outside in the dumpster, and the garbage man's going to take it away. And then you get a party and you get cake. And then he threw it away, and then we go inside and have cake, and he says, where binky? Where be? It's like, you didn't quite get it, kid. It's done. We can't pay your dental bills the rest of your life if you have this pacifier much longer. So your 1-year-old, fun-loving and fussy, infancy, trust versus mistrust. Then we go into toddlerhood, stage 2, autonomy versus shame and doubt. In addition to autonomy versus shame and doubt, another way to think of the second stage is independence versus dependence. Like in the first stage, toddlers go through the stage responding to their caregivers. If caregivers encourage them to be independent and explore the world on their own, toddlers will grow up with a sense of self-efficacy. If the caregivers hover excessively or encourage dependence, toddlers grow up with less confidence in their abilities. For example, if a toddler wants to walk without assistance in a safe area, the caregiver should encourage this autonomy by allowing independent behavior. The caregiver insists on holding the toddler's hand even when it's not necessary. This attention can lead to doubt later in life. I'd also say that in toddlerhood, the autonomy can be stunted if a caregiver, a parent, or whoever's watching the child is overly harsh with a toddler. Like, they're trying to figure out things, and they're going to make mistakes, going to make messes, they're going to break things. And if you're overly harsh and disciplined when a toddler didn't know any better, that will hurt their autonomy. They'll have shame and doubt. Maybe they really can't do things. And so that hurts their development in that respect. So that takes us back to the Ames books, Your Two-Year-Old, the subtitle, Your Two-Year-Old, Terrible or Tender, and Your Three-Year-Old, Friend or Enemy. And boy, isn't that true. People always say the terrible twos, like, oh, watch out for the terrible twos. In my experience, it's not the terrible twos that are the hardest. It's being a three-nager. That when a child reaches the age of three, I've heard it said before that they're a lot closer developmentally to a 10-year-old than a 1-year-old. That it's a huge difference when you go from one to three. Like, we have a 1-year-old, they're an infant. When you have a 2-year-old, they're an overgrown, babbling, walking infant. But when you get to three, they can talk about things, they can really relate even to adults, and so they want to do more, but they're really hampered by a lack of motor skills, a lack of emotional regulation. They just feel like they want to jump out of their own skins because they want so much more out of life, but they physiologically can't have it right now. And so you get the tantrums, the explosive, crazy tantrums that you don't really see again until a child is 12 or 13. Which, because once again, you have the same dilemma, right? You get your 13, 14 years old, especially 12, 13, and you hit puberty. And for a child, it's like you want to explode out of your own skin. You want so many more things in life, but physiologically, you just can't have them yet at that age. So you throw a tantrum again, like you did when you were three almost. Friend or enemy, three-year-old, terrible or tender, the two-year-old. And that's true. I have a two-year-old right now, and he, my little John Paul, he's so cute. He really is terrible or tender. Like, he'll give me little tender kisses, and then he'll be absolutely terrible sometimes. John Paul, put that away, please. No, I don't. No. The power of no. When a child discovers no, it is like they discovered the magic lamp from Aladdin with infinite wishes. Like, it's like they have the infinity stones. Like, no, I can say no. And they just get drunk with power from that. All right. Next stage in Erickson, stage three, preschool years, initiative versus guilt. During the preschool years, children learn to assert themselves and speak up when they need something. So we're talking here like ages, so we're 3 to 5 to 6. It goes into early school. I'm going to call this ages like 4 to 6. Some children may state that they're sad because a friend stole their toy. If this assertiveness is greeted with a positive reaction, they learn that taking initiative is helpful behavior. However, if they're made to feel guilty or ashamed for their assertiveness, they may grow up to be timid and less likely to take the lead. So when preschool years, you see a child growing out, whether they actually go to preschool or they interact more with older siblings or other children. You know, you have like little kids, right? They get to a point where they're playing next to each other, like when they're a toddler, till they start playing with each other and understanding the rules of engagement, so to speak. And that can create a struggle between initiative and guilt. So going back to Ames, that would be things like your 4-year-old and your 5-year-old. Your 4-year-old, subtitle, wild and wonderful. And your 5-year-old, sunny and serene. And I agree with this too. I mean, no kid is easy or perfect, right? 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds can get on your nerves about things. But your 4-year-old, wild and wonderful, sunny and serene for your 5-year-old, I think that's very true, that you've grown out of the toddler stage. And it is really refreshing to be in this little child stage where you're a lot closer to relating to someone like an adult. Now, they still have a lot of issues, but they're growing out of the tantrum phase of the 2- and 3-year-old, but they're not quite at the defiant stages or the seeking a lot more independent stages of the older early childhood years. So I find that to be a very enjoyable time, your 4-year-old and your 5-year-old, but it can still have its difficulties. Stage 4, early school years. So we might call this elementary school, primary school, elementary school. Early school years, industry versus inferiority, the struggle for kids like from ages 6 to 10, 6 to 12. When children begin school, they start to compare themselves with peers. If children feel they're accomplished in relation to peers, they develop strong self-esteem. If, however, they notice that other children have met milestones that they haven't, they may struggle with self-esteem. For example, a first grader may notice a consistently worse performance on spelling tests when compared with peers, If this becomes a pattern, it can lead to feelings of inferiority. So we have here, going into elementary school, a concern not so much about fitting in. Elementary school students kind of do what they want. I mean, you are establishing friendship bonds and worrying about popularity a little bit, but it's not the kind of introspection that you have in the teen years. It's not the kind of concern that everybody's looking at me. I remember once, not to fast forward too much, but I remember once Laura and I went to a Texas Roadhouse for lunch. This was a long time ago. I don't even know if we had kids or if we had kids or parents were watching them. And it was delightful, by the way. The best thing about Texas Roadhouse is not the meat, it's the bread. You get the buns with that honey cinnamon butter that you put on it. And I just want basket after basket of that bread. And so you're sitting there and we looked over and we saw there's like this 13-year-old boy who's his birthday. And the Texas Roadhouse waitresses come around. They're like these college girls or waitresses. And they bring out a sawhorse for him to sit on to like sing happy birthday. Something like that. And he just sits there, his head down. He's like, I'm not going to do it. And not moving. And so they start singing to him anyways. And it's so funny because I could see a look on his head. He must have been 12 or 13. Like, everybody's looking at me. Well, yeah, everybody's looking at you now because you're being a sourpuss instead of just having fun with it. That's the ultimate paradox of the moody 12 or 13-year-old. You're worried everybody's looking at you, but nobody would care. But when you pout about things and act moody, that is actually when everybody is looking at you, kid. And you don't figure it out at that age. You just figure it out when you're older and wiser, when you become the soldier, the justice, and then the pantaloon, as Shakespeare would say. So in these early school years, we go back to Ames. This would be your 6-year-old, 7 and 8, and 9-year-old. Your 6-year-old, loving and defiant. Oh boy, we're starting to get that with our 6-year-old. Your 7-year-old, life in a minor key. That's probably one of my favorite titles in all of this, except for Terrible or Tender. Your 7-year-old, life in a minor key. That is so true. That Ames describes a 7-year-old that when you look at a 7-year-old, they're trying really hard to be like a little adult, especially if they are the oldest and they have younger siblings. They try to be parent number 3. And so it's, sometimes that's helpful, especially when they're a girl, the oldest girl. We have all boys, so it's just chaos, messiness, violence, and brawling, and bro time in our house. And I would not trade it for anything. I would love to have a girl. If we're blessed with a girl, that would be wonderful. But for now, it is really fun having the team boys, the bro team at the Horn household. Life in a minor key, because it's like, you know, imagine you play a song, but you play it in the minor key. You can recognize the song, but it still sounds off, not quite right. And that's your 7-year-old trying to be an adult, and they're still nowhere near it. But they've reached around the age of reason, so they can be held accountable, morally accountable, for the decisions that they make, more so than when they were a toddler or even a younger child. Your 8-year-old, lively and outgoing. Our 8-year-old is the liveliest kid in the world. I love him, though. And he's outgoing. He wants to go to the park by himself. He wants to do all these projects. He wants to build a robot. He wants to do all of these things. Lively and outgoing. And finally, the Ames series ends, at least with the subtitle. She has a book called Your 10 through 14-Year-Old, but it ends with your 9-year-old, thoughtful and mysterious. We're not there yet, but I can see when kids reach ages 9 and 10, they start to seclude a little bit because they're not teens yet, but they're not little kids either. They're in this limbo, if you will. So they become more withdrawn with that respect. They're thoughtful and mysterious. All right, we got 4 more stages then of Erikson. Stage 5 is adolescence, identity versus role confusion. So this would be your teen years, especially ages junior high, high school is what I would put it at, adolescence, identity versus role confusion. The adolescent stage is where the term identity crisis originated, and for good reason. Adolescence is all about developing a sense of self. Adolescents who can clearly identify who they are grow up with stronger goals and self-knowledge than teenagers who struggle to break free of their parents' or friends' influences. Adolescents who still deeply depend on their parents for social interaction and guidance may experience more role confusion than teenagers who pursue their own interests. So adolescence is a great time. I'm not there yet. I'm at the midway point of life. I'm at the midway point of raising children. So I don't have personal experience with this. But from what I can gather from friends and from my own adolescence, this is a time where you say, you know, I'm not going to be like my mom and dad. I'm different than them. Whereas when you were a younger child, you want to be just like them. I love that right now. What do you want to be when you grow up? Well, my kids want to be a NASA scientist, a priest, or an author like dad. And so I love hearing that. But one day they're gonna have their own things that they want to do. And that's good. I want to support them in that. And they're going to grow into a stage where they realize I'm my own person. I want to figure out who I am. And the goal here is a struggle between identity and role confusion, whether you can develop a healthy sense of identity. I know who I am, who I want to be, even if it's the seeds of who I am that have to blossom later, if you will, versus I don't know who I am. I'm just going to be like my parents. I'll do what my parents say. Or I'm going to do what my friends say. I'm just going to try to fit into this group, this clique at school. Or in worst case scenario, this gang that I am a part of, I want to fit in with them. And so you're dependent on others for identity when you should be developing your own sense of identity. And that's the struggle as Catholic parents, right? Your kids say, I don't want to be like my mom and dad. You want them to have, you don't want them to copy our faith. Their faith shouldn't just be doing what mom and dad do, because that'll wither when they're adults. But you also don't want them to, of course, leave the faith. You want them to develop the faith that so it is their own and they own it and they have that authentic encounter with Christ and it truly is part of their identity. Stage 6, young adulthood, intimacy versus isolation. In young adulthood, which begins roughly at age 20, people begin to solidify lifelong bonds. They may enter committed relationships or marriages. Others form lifelong friendships. People who can create and maintain these relationships reap emotional benefits, while those who struggle to maintain relationships may suffer from isolation. A young adult who develops strong friendships in college may feel more intimacy than one who struggles to form and maintain close friendships. So we move here from adolescence, trying to figure out who I am, to young adulthood, 20s, 30s, not who am I, but who am I going to be with? Who will be with me in life? Who will continue this journey of life next to me to share these experiences with, whether it is a spouse, whether it is a close friendship? And so you go and seek this out. So what's difficult here is that I'm not a big fan of college. I feel like college oftentimes, especially because it's a waste of money, and it wastes time also, but it really can be a debt trap. And so I'm very concerned about college in that respect. But college is, I will admit, it is a good place to meet people, to meet spouses, meet friends. It does become hard after college to be able to do that. So I see some of the benefit there in that institution, though I do think the harms usually end up outweighing it. And there's other communities you can be a part of to meet others, young adult groups, religious groups, other things like that. But that's the concern here, especially those who feel called to the vocation of marriage, that if you feel like, oh, you're dating and you're constantly having relationships that aren't working, or you have friendships that are falling apart, you can have a sense of isolation, feeling alone, versus that sense of intimacy of finding others who want to share life with you, whether it's friendship or whether it's romantic life. Last two stages, stage 7, middle adulthood. I think that's where I'm at now, middle adulthood, midlife. And the struggle there is between generativity versus stagnation. So it says, in middle adulthood, people tend to struggle with their contributions to society. They may be busy raising children or pursuing careers. Those who feel that they're contributing experience generativity, which is a sense of leaving a legacy. On the other hand, those who don't feel that their work or lives matter may experience feelings of stagnation. For example, a middle-aged adult who's raising a family and working in a career that presumably helps people may feel more fulfilled than an adult who's working at a day job that feels meaningless. This reminds me a little bit of the play Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller, a tragic play. I mean, it's a classic in American literature. You definitely should read it or go see it. But it's just so sad, you know, talking about the main character who is a salesman who feels like he hasn't really accomplished much in life. And he's lamenting that, though that will get in a little bit to the last stage, late adulthood. But you see this, that when people are in their late 30s, 40s, 50s, this sense that maybe you're raising children, they might be little, they might be older, high school, going off to college, you have children, you're in the midst of your career or prime of what should be your career. And so the thing you're struggling with now would be, what am I contributing to society? What am I doing right now? I have the opportunity to contribute to my family, to my children, to society. Am I generating something that is of value from my work? Or if you're a mother, am I generating something of value in how I've been raising my children? Or then there are other moms, of course, who have careers or jobs that they do, or women who aren't married, men who aren't married. What have I generated? What have I given to society? Is my life mattering right now? What's that difference with the next stage? Because stage 8 is late adulthood. And the struggle here is between integrity versus despair. So middle adulthood, the big difference here is what I am doing right now, I have the opportunity to get my butt in gear and contribute to society, to family, to those I care about? Or am I stagnant? Am I just going day to day and feeling like I am not really helping? And I think also, once again, our faith really informs us here, because we can have generativity. The world may say you're not experiencing generativity unless you're having all these breakthroughs and you're successful and you're wealthy, or you've meet all these worldly accomplishments. No, you can have generativity if you are a custodian, or if you are a caretaker of someone, but that every day you feel like, I served the Lord today and I served those around me. Even if I have a job that people will call menial, that I serve them with the joy of Christ and I brought that joy to them. And so you can experience that in all the little things that you do. So I think that it's not about necessarily what you do, it's the mindset you bring to it at this stage of middle adulthood. But the difference here between middle adulthood and late adulthood would be that stage 8, late adulthood, integrity versus despair, is about looking back on life. Middle adulthood, you're in the midst of it. What can I do right now? What am I doing? Is this worthwhile? You're in the midst of things, your work you're doing, whether it's career or family. Stage 8 says, as adults reach the end of life, they look back on their lives and reflect. Adults who feel fulfilled by their lives, either through a successful family or a meaningful career, reach ego integrity in which they can face aging and dying with peace. If older adults don't feel that they've lived a good life, they risk falling into despair. And so that would be the end of the stage. As Shakespeare says, and as you like it, it's the second childhood. You're now dependent on other people. We're talking here about 60s, but especially going into 70s and 80s, when your mobility is restricted, you're usually retired from work or you're unable to work. If you have children, they're grown and they could be in the midst of middle adulthood at this point of raising their own families. And so now is the point where you're standing at the precipice, the edge of life, and you look back and you think, all right, was it a life lived well? I actually just recently went to the funeral of my wife's grandmother, to be my children's great-grandmother, and I've only been to 3 funerals in life. I think it's been 3 that I've been to. And it's very different to see the difference. So this woman lived to be almost 100 years old. And she lived a good life. And so the feeling at the funeral is so different, because the other funerals I've been to, one was for a teenager who died of a drug overdose. The other was of a 19-year-old, this girl, Katie. She was a very good friend of mine. She died from influenza suddenly. I actually gave the eulogy at her funeral. If I find it, actually, maybe I'll share it with you on a future Free For All Friday. It was the hardest talk I've ever had to give. I was asked to give the eulogy. Nobody else was in a state to do it. I've had public speaking experience. It's still very, very difficult. But the difference, so very different. You go to a funeral for a 19-year-old who dies suddenly. It's overwhelmingly tragic and sad to be involved at something like that. But when you go to a funeral for a 99-year-old, people are smiling. There's this sense of happiness, of warmth, because we see here is someone who lived a life well and was the natural time to go on now, to go and be with the Lord. And so when you reach that late adulthood, now is a time when finally you're looking back. You only have a little bit of life ahead of you, but you look back and wonder, was it worthwhile? Was it worthwhile? So you definitely want to plan for that now, to make it worthwhile in living life and not wasting it on scrolling on your phone or doing things that are ultimately inconsequential. And if you are in late adulthood, because if you don't do that, if you don't invest now in life emotionally and spiritually, you become more of who you are, right? So if you were a joyful person when you were younger, you're going to become that wonderful, kooky, joyful older adult or 80 or 90-year-old that people just love having around, who can feel so young even though they're older. But if you are cynical and you are always blaming other people for your problems as your 30s, 40s, and 50s, then you will be that cynical, bitter old person yelling at everybody to get off his lawn. You know, we don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. So I think that's something to definitely consider. And so I just think this is interesting to look at our lives, the lives that God gave us, and we don't know how long. We're not guaranteed all 8 stages. As I just said, you know, you could, your life, you are but a vapor in the wind. Life can be taken from you in this very moment. So we should always be grateful to God for the days that he's given us. But if he chooses to give us a full life to go through all 8 stages, to go through the entire play that Shakespeare spoke of, let's stay close to him and try to live the life well that he has blessed us with. So thank you guys so much, and I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.